Tonight, I want to start some comments more in reflection and sadness than even in anger. I'm often asked, as I was asked today, why do I bother taking on issues that are so large, that are printed on, not printed, that are painted on such a large tableau, issues of freedom, issues of individual consequence over the state, issues of our most important rights. And the reason is real simple. There aren't that many things that matter in this world. The human being in this veil of tears isn't just the animal who knows that he knows. If we're just the animal that he knows that he knows, then we produce more. We have better computers. We make more money. We have more cars. How does that make us any better than gorillas that have more bananas? It doesn't. What makes this veil of tears of a life bearable are the things about the human condition and the human being that can't be quantified, that aren't empirical. Art and music and passion and literature and all those things that come out of the protection of our individuality and the fullest expression of it. And any threat to those things makes everything else inconsequential. The idea for this show was born out of the notion that there are many of you out there that want not just entertainment, but want elucidation, want elevation, want to hear the facts and the passion that gives them the courage to speak truth to power, that's important for you. I know that's important for you because we're flooded with emails. We're flooded with calls from people asking us, how can I respond? What's my way of response? I'm frustrated with this. And we take away from here the ability to train people and make them better. Make them better in the sense that they feel better about themselves. They don't worry just about protecting the pettiness of their lives. They take a chance. They make their own destiny. Because if we lose the freedom to be courageous, nothing else matters. The $5 a day daycares, the renaming of streets, the pettiness of state control over everything. That's petty nonsense. If we don't take back control of our lives, if we don't as individuals have respect for our own minds and hearts, and if we as a country don't have more respect for ourselves and our vision. And these thoughts are brought home to me today, not only because of a number of phone calls that I received of people who we've trained and interns that we've trained who are doing things out there and making things happen for the most vulnerable in society. But what drove it home to me in the sense that I wanted to share this reflection with you is that when Chorus Radio, and credit is due to them, gave me the chance to do this show this way, it wasn't an easy thing to do. Charlie Rose was asked about his talk show on PBS that it wouldn't exactly excite everybody. He says, no, it will. People do want to be elevated. They want to be educated, and they want to be given examples of courage. And sometimes that message has to be repeated again and again and again and again, because the rest of the time, all you get is the little stuff, and you lose sight of what's important. And what struck me this morning, even before the call started coming in, was a story in the Globe and Mail where a business group in British Columbia was criticizing Prime Minister Harper for taking a stand on human rights with China. He wouldn't give in when China wanted human rights off the table in their discussions. They threatened to cancel the meeting. Eventually, they gave in. But listen to what this businessman, Dale Blackburn, said as to the reason that Mr. Harper should back down. China is an important market for us, Mr. Blackburn said yesterday. Its middle class is growing and their influence is increasing. They want to eat fresh seafood, and Canada has a tremendous reputation for that. Memo to Mr. Blackburn. Canada's reputation is not built on our ability to produce fresh seafood. It is built and will be maintained on our ability to produce brave and bold citizens that are involved in mankind's transcendent yearnings for redemptive change. We'll be back with our first guest demo after this. This has not been a good week for sane and rational international policies, nor for the future of a sane and rational and peaceful world. First came the report of this Alliance of Civilizations project, where among 20 leaders and ex-leaders, including such great defenders of freedom as Mohammad Khatami, the former president of Iran, they concluded that the only problem with the Islamic world is really not a religious problem, but a political problem involving Arabs and Israelis. So we shouldn't really worry about the Ahmadinejads. First piece of intelligence and rationalization. Later on in the week, Hezbollah kept the Lebanese government hostage, demanding a veto power. Human Rights Council, meeting in Geneva, the United Nations Human Rights Council, which has never said a word about Darfur, which has never said a word about 9,000 attacks on the only free state, free nation, true democracy in the middle rim of this small planet, once again condemned Israel, this time for the bombings in Gaza, without saying a word about the Qassam rocket attacks that destroys the city of Sderot in Israel. We've had the prime minister of this country under attack for maintaining a strong human rights policy vis-a-vis China. It's a world turned upside down. People sometimes don't understand what they're giving up when they compromise. They give up their futures. In the midst of all this, Gregory Levy, who was an assistant professor of communications at Ryerson University in Toronto, and has a fascinating background, having served as the English speechwriter for Israeli Prime Ministers Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert, believes that this may be a time, in the midst of all this, to pursue a Middle East peace. And this is Professor Levy's first time with us, and we welcome you, and you're joining us from Boston tonight. Thank you, Gregory, for taking the time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
All right. Tell me why I should be optimistic after speaking all week with Hillel Neuer from Geneva at the Human Rights Council and on and on and on.
Oh, you should definitely not be optimistic. But you should not rule out the possibility of positive developments. There's been a number of them. There's several possibilities of various plans. With the Saudis are floating around their plan again, and there's some talk of Qatar being more welcoming to Israel. And there's even among the Palestinians, there are moderates speaking up. I mean, these are good things to think about. But no, I'm not suggesting you should be particularly optimistic.
You paint one fascinating scenario that even if we assume that the way the United Nations and other countries in Europe, particularly like Spain, whose prime minister started this alliance of civilizations and put the Arab-Israeli issue front and center and sort of is telling us to ignore the Islamofascism that we're facing, you've painted a picture, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that it's almost without reference to Lebanon, there are back-channel structures being put into place that involve Israel and certain frontline states such as Egypt, Jordan, and even Saudi Arabia, and it's almost as if, are they talking to get to a point at which they will then go to Lebanon and say, okay, now here's your strength, government of Lebanon, to tell Hezbollah to hit the road?
Well, the Middle East is very interesting. It's more interesting than people realize at first. There's various layers of things going on at all times. There's the stuff you see on the news, and then there's a deeper level of analysis you can perhaps pick up through reading. But then there's stuff further down, which are, yeah, as you suggest, back-channel negotiations. And some of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes would blow your mind. Contacts between arch-enemies, Israel and their nemesis, negotiating.
What is the plural of nemesis? That's a very good
question.
I don't know either.
I'm a professor.
Of communications yet.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'll have to look that up. But nemesis?
Nemesis, I was just thinking of that.
No, there's all kinds of strange things that go on behind the scenes. And in my time with the Israeli government, I was privy to some of them, much of which I can't speak of. But a lot of it is super interesting. And, you know, they present the possibility of then coming out in the open with stuff later. I don't think Lebanon's the key issue, to be honest. It's really a symptom of a larger issue, which is the Iran. And it's the Sunni-Shiite split in the Middle East that presents a possibility for peace in a perverse sort of way.
And I want to talk to you about that, and particularly some comments you had to make about Syria in a recent piece you wrote right after this.
Okay.
Short break. And we're talking with Gregory Levy, a professor for communications at Ryerson University in Toronto, who also served as English speechwriter for Israeli Prime Ministers Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert. And he believes that there may be glimmers of possibilities, I'm using my words carefully, to pursue a Mideast peace, even amidst the ongoing chaos in the region and the ongoing hypocrisies of the in international organizations. Gregory, you mentioned Syria. Now, the Baker Report in the United States is recommending that America somehow try to pull Syria out of the Iranian orbit. Is it a necessity to have Syria involved with Jordan and Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Egypt? Gregory? Sorry, we've had a technical glitch, and we're just going to get Gregory Levy back, professor of communication at Ryerson. His message was that even in the midst of all this, there are back-channel negotiations going on that could result in some interesting situations. Gregory Levy, you're back?
Yes, I am back.
Okay, sorry about that glitch.
No.
What I was saying was I was following up on your comments about Syria. The Baker Report, of course, is recommending that some kind of effort be made to pull Syria out of Iran's orbit. Is Syria necessary if something is going on with Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan?
Oh, I don't know if we know what the Baker Report's going to suggest yet. Syria is kind of a wild card in the whole issue, though. You know, you have basically the Shiites on one side led by Iran and the Sunnis on the other side led by Egypt and the Saudis. But and then Syria kind of hangs in the balance. It's hard to say if they're necessary, but, I mean, they can hurt things or help things.
The leaks on the Baker Report have focused on Syria for a week already, but it's going to take a considerable amount of money to pull Syria out of Iran's orbit, and if Iran lets it.
Yeah, it's going to take the very least money, maybe other things. Concessions would be another thing.
And but despite all the best-laid plans of what we would call the moderate Sunni world, in Saudi Arabia, the Saudi royal family is right now worried about the Wahhabi clerical establishment. They're really worried about a large-scale Shiite uprising, but Shiites out of Iran that have made common cause with the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, with the Al-Qaeda, who are not Shiites, but it's now taken on not what the Alliance of Civilization said was an irreligious war, but a religious political war. Can this confrontation really be avoided, regardless of what happens between Israel and Palestine?
That's a huge issue. I can't answer that definitively. But
let me rephrase that.
Sure.
Will any chance for an Arab, for a Palestinian-Israeli settlement, and even one in Lebanon, be subverted by Iranian political ambitions?
It very well might be. It very well might be. Like I said, I'm not optimistic. I don't recommend you are optimistic, but there are these possibilities.
I'm not optimistic by nature.
That's good. That's why I trust you. But there are these possibilities. We have to at least try. But no, I mean, the dangers are large.
You make a point that Canada's support for Israel didn't go unnoticed in Israel. But more importantly, The Prime Minister's support of Israel has been firmly based on one principle. It's not about votes, certainly. It's certainly not about political contributions. It's about a principled stand that it's time for Canada to stand with a sister democracy and for, frankly, all democracies to say enough to this wave of a new fascism sweeping over the world and threatening the Western liberal pluralistic world. More importantly than whether Harper's stand has been noticed in Israel, Has it been noticed in Europe since La Francophonie and since the Prime Minister's very principled stand there on that resolution?
That's a very interesting question. Has Canada, under the Harper government, sort of lost its sway with the Europeans?
Not lost. I'm suggesting the opposite. That in Bucharest at the Francophonie summit.
Right. No. I remember.
He put the lie to the fact that Canada is a middle power. He said no to France, no to Egypt. He walked out.
Right.
And
but
we won.
If you watch Jacques Chirac's face when that happened, he was clearly not happy, and he actually mumbled something about telling to come back.
Well, do you think that Canada can now play a more important role with Europe?
It would be nice. What I worry is that maybe it will be forced to play a less important role because it will be sort of grouped in with the Bush administration from a European point of view. I'm not endorsing or talking against it. I'm just saying from a European point of view.
Gregory Levy, thanks very, very much for taking the time to be with us tonight, and this will not be the last time we'll be talking.
I hope not.
Absolutely. Montreal, we'll be right back after this, and we're going to take your calls. We've got calls building up. We're going to go to Robert first, right after the break. And if you're a Roger subscriber, it's *940, and from Bell, it's #940. And you can email us with your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. Let's get some pressure off the lines and go to Robert. Robert, good evening.
Hi, Beryl. How are you?
Okay, you.
Not too bad. I don't want to. I know you're talking about the whole Middle East muddle, but I want to move a little back east because you were talking about the Sudan a little earlier.
Yes.
You know, I know you were talking about the whole delegation, the way Harper got snubbed by the Chinese delegation. What amazes me though is the whole lip service. You know, that the international community is playing to Darfur, even though it's pretty high profile. And getting a lot of airtime on various American networks by different NGOs. What I can't believe is that the UN is completely neutered. Their envoy can't go in there. There is 125 Senegalese so-called peacekeepers
right.
from the African Union there. There's been an ethnic cleansing of over 200,000 people. And there's
2 million
not that
displaced.
Much of an outcry. You know, I'll tell you, Barry, I'll take you to task with Afghanistan because I know you really believe in the mission there. I know you do. I don't. But I'll say one thing. Canada being silent on Sudan really does say something to me.
Well, Robert, you know, sometimes calls like yours lift my spirits when you just read what I read today about the businessman and Harper and human rights. It's even worse than what you're saying. It's not just that the United Nations is neutered. It's almost as if it's an international conspiracy of silence. Remember at the very beginning why there was no outcry in the Sudan. Yes, all the official reasons were internal civil war. The fact is, this was a genocide. But Canada's business interests were involved then, where Talisman Energy.
Oh, that's where I was about to. You know what? You just.
And
just,
their interests.
You hit it bang on there.
And their interests were protected. So while at the same time the liberal governments of Krejci and Martin were trying to play virgins, we were protecting the interests of oil companies.
Yeah, but very
and it gets worse. When finally the outcry about that reached a certain level, we had for the former Prime Minister Martin's trip to Libya looking for oil leases for a small group of oil companies, calling Gaddafi a man with a philosophical bent of mind. Meanwhile, these people are being killed, and you're quite right. The international community is neutered. One man, Robert, one man named John Prendergast, who was head of the African desk of the National Security Council under Clinton, decided to leave his job. Go to Chad, and he opened the largest what is now the largest refugee camp. He's now working with the International Crisis Group in Washington. He's been profiled on 60 Minutes. One person can make that kind of a difference.
But, Beryl, I'm going to say this. Getting back to Talisman, I'm going to say one thing. When Talisman were there, they took a lot of heat. And the reason why I'm bringing this about, because, you know, you were talking about the Chinese delegation, but let me tell you one thing.
When actually, the not Chinese, the delegation. Beryl, it's the Chinese prime minister who refused to meet.
I know, but when the Chinese bought Talisman's assets, because they control them now, that's why Talisman had to get out, because there was too much pressure on Talisman and Jim Buckey, the CEO. But when China got the assets, China owns the assets of Talisman. Talisman's out of there. China owns. They've struck the deal with Sudan. You know what it is? It's a one-sided game. China can take the resources. They don't. They pledge a neutral stance of not having to live up to any sort of foreign commitments. And meanwhile, I don't want to even get into the whole outsourcing of the whole economy.
You're absolutely dead on. And I just want to make two points that'll make you more nauseated. We at the Institute 2.5 years ago started demonstrations in Montreal, calling on the Liberal government just to call Darfur a genocide. We got nowhere. Recently, when China Minmetals tried to buy Inco and Falconbridge and openly said they want our minerals for their expanded military needs and they're going to take our processing jobs out of here, we were also involved with other groups that waged a letter-writing campaign to Ottawa to stop the deal. And for whatever role we played, that deal did not go through. China Minmetals, of course, reports to the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China. China is doing exactly what you say, and the world is letting them get away with it. Robert, have you got time to hold on? Because they're making vicious signals at me because they've got to pay some bills. And we'll be right back with Robert and with all of you right after this. And we're continuing our conversation with Robert. And Robert, you know, when I get a caller like you, you've got it so dead on. It gives me energy as to continue doing what we're doing here. I wanted to expand on what you were talking about, China being in control of the Darfur situation through its control of energy companies and its influence in the international community, because China's biggest partner is the United Nations. You have a Secretary General in the United Nations who covered up the oil for food scandal to protect his son, who's the main beneficiary of the oil for food scandal in dollars, happened to be Maurice Strong, sits on the board of Power Corp, and is a dollar-a-year man to Paul Martin, who was also the special UN envoy to North Korea on disarmament. And when it was found out what he was doing with oil for food, he was fired from that, and he was the main guy running around the world in all these trouble spots where China could have an influence. And nobody, not from Canada, not from the United Nations, nobody asked him to do anything.
Yeah, but, Beryl, charity begins at home. You know that? Look at Bill Clinton. He's the great humanitarian. He gave China most favored nation status. Didn't even blink when Rwanda happened. I mean, you know, I mean, what a great humanitarian.
It's,
a right winger, Beryl.
Robert, I understand. I know we've talked before. But, you know, the mistakes of the past, I like to look a little bit further than Bill Clinton. I'm still looking for the Henry Jacksons and the Charles Vaneks who in the late 70s said no to most favored nation trading status to Russia until it freed its political dissidents. And then America, under a feckless president like Jimmy Carter, and then finally under Reagan, got Europe to sign on to the Helsinki Final Act and freed Russia. So I'm not going to be completely pessimistic, and certainly not with people like you out there who are so on point. Robert, I thank you very much for your call.
Thank you. Keep it up.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
George Bernard Shaw wrote a very famous line that liberty demands responsibility. That's why so many dread it. Our next guest doesn't dread it. He grasps it. Because that's the point of being alive, is to be responsible and speak truth to power. Professor Peter March of St. Mary's University has been on with us before, and you may remember when there was the whole Mohammed cartoon issue in Europe. Professor March was the first one to post the cartoons on his door in his university and got a lot of heat for it. Didn't stop him. Peter March is about to start a Canadian tour on the question of Islam and democracy. And is it possible to have a fit unless there's a rejection of state faith? And he couldn't have started in a better place than here in Montreal. In the hotbed of appeasement at Concordia University, he will be speaking at 8:30 on Tuesday night, this coming Tuesday night, in room H435. And if I'm not wrong about the dates, Tuesday night is... The E is November 21st or 22nd, Peter?
The 21st.
The 21st. And a more fitting week for a rallying cry for freedom couldn't have come, because the next day, of course, is the sad 33rd anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. Peter March, welcome. And thank you for your courage. Now, let me ask you, after everything you've been through and the headaches, and we've talked endlessly on the phones, off the lines, what made you decide to do this? You got a nice, relaxed life out there in Halifax.
Well, it was relaxed until, as you say, I put up the cartoons. And
I know.
After, the relaxation ended with, of course, the kind of threats that you had, and also a whole series of official complaints by students here at St. Mary's were lodged against me, and a very large university committee set to work over a period of half a dozen months to try to censor me or get my job or whatever it was their plan. In any case, those complaints have now all been withdrawn. And it seemed to me that the appropriate thing at this point to do was to study the problem further, go across Canada, speak to every commentator I could, Muslim and otherwise, and learn as much as I could about the possibility of a solution to the problem.
The core of the problem, of course, rests in the fact that nowhere in the Islamic world, save Turkey, and that was in 1926, when Kemal Atatürk literally had to abolish any participation of religion in the political life of the country, there has been no division between state and faith in any Islamic country. Now,
that's correct.
If
in
that
fact,
doesn't happen, do we have any hope?
No, and when I speak on Tuesday, I will argue that the reality is that Islamic culture is a culture of slavery. The slaves are the women, of course. They are sex and domestic slaves in that culture. And in a culture of slavery where individual rights are trampled, women are threatened, beaten, killed, it's inconceivable that such a culture would fit in seamlessly through dreams of multiculturalism in the Canadian context. So I will argue on Tuesday that the only hope for Islamic culture in North America is that there be a reformation. They have to actively change their stance on a whole series of issues, and I'll be covering those.
And I'm going to go through some of the seminal points you'll be covering right after this. We're just going to take a very short break, Peter. And we're speaking with Professor Peter March of St. Mary's University in Halifax, who, as you may remember, was one of the few brave intellectuals in Canada who, at the time of the Mohammed cartoon affair, posted the cartoons on his office door and got into a lot of hot water with that. He's starting a cross-country speaking tour. He'll be in Montreal Tuesday night at 8:30 at Concordia University in room H435, speaking on Islam and democracy. And Professor March, you were making the point before the break that without an understanding by Muslims that faith and state are need a firewall between them, our concept of multiculturalism, forget about the international issues, our concept of multiculturalism in Canada is threatened by it.
That's right. The classic idea of multiculturalism presupposed that there was a separation of religion and state. So that we never expected when we supported multiculturalism that that would imply that a particular religion like Islam, who claims the right to intrude into every aspect of life, from education to government to the judiciary, etc., would appear on the horizon and challenge all the institutions of the state under the banner of multiculturalism. But obviously that's absurd. The only way you could conceivably have multiculturalism is if you exclude a full-blooded religion like Islam. Now, the reason we were able to have it before Islam appeared, of course, is because we have very, very strenuously repressed Christianity. We pushed it out of government, we pushed it out of the courts, we pushed it out of education, we pushed it out of science.
And rightly so. We tried
and
to push
so.
All religion.
So we have repressed all religion to clear the decks for democracy. Suddenly,
and suddenly
Islam
we
appeared.
Have a wave of everybody.
Yes, and I may say that I've given this lecture at Dalhousie, St. Mary's, University of New Brunswick, and in Newfoundland. And although I have spoken to many Muslims, I have not spoken, at these lectures at least, to any Muslim women, not at least knowingly.
Well,
when I was invited to the mosque in Fredericton, I was in the company of 20 men. And when I was at the prayer session, the women were there, but invisible and inaudible behind a partition.
This is the ground zero point. And as you know, the Institute just finished a conference in Montreal that was attended by over 400 people called Questions of Values, Ways of Response to the Islamist Challenge. And the questions of values were our values as Western liberal pluralist societies. all the spokespeople were women. All from Islamic countries, though not all Muslim. And the point they were making was precisely one of the points that you make in one of your memos, that when fundamentalist Muslims come to the West, because they see a secular society and they see this division between state and faith, and they come with the mindset that there can be no division between state and faith because in their worlds, faith exists, they have the right to ignore the secular rules.
That's right. I think it's a very difficult philosophical lesson that the West went through, which is to realize that the rules that organize a state do not, although they have to be principled and show moral values, they do not have to originate in religion or in a consensus about religion. So that when the average member of an Islamic culture comes here, the whole idea that there would be in a secular state a stable and viable set of principles, moral principles, is very, very hard to accept. And when they look across Canada, they see a secular society, they conclude immediately that obviously it's without values.
And indeed,
they assume religion.
And indeed, you know, many of us, many secular Muslims, just as, you know, there are secular Christians, secular Jews, they don't need religion. You know, whether they believe in God or not is not a point. They face pressure within their own communities because they're considered even worse than the infidels because they just don't want anything to do with religion.
Exactly. I mean, there's a whole series of things that are not being said about the problem of Islam in Canada. And they're being covered up, they're being washed out. And it's astounding that under the banner of sensitivity and multiculturalism, that effectively the academic community, the intellectual community, has been virtually silent.
Silent. Well, we're very politically correct, but in this country, but there are beacons of freedom and beacons of liberty, and you're one. And Peter March, you'll be with us Monday night in studio. And to the listeners out there, many of you who are members of the Institute will be getting a notice of the lectures. And Peter, we wish you much luck and good courage.
Thank you very much. Well, very good.
Montreal, that's why we do what we do. People like Professor Peter March, callers like Robert, because what we do with our lives is not a matter of chance. It doesn't have to be decided by convention. What we do with our lives is a matter of choice, and you can't wait for it. We've got to mold it, and we've got to achieve it. So get out there and start working. My thanks to Nick Mays, as always, and Master Control. We'll be back with you Monday night.